I'm now working as a doctor and I've just started training as a psychiatrist. So I was particularly interested to read an article the other day that was put together by PostSecret. I don't know if any of you have heard of PostSecret. And they asked people throughout most of the Western world, but who had been admitted to psychiatric hospitals, what is the one thing that they wanted to communicate about that experience? And some people talked about how good it was to finally get the help that they needed. A lot of people talked about the stigma of their, of mental illness and how they'd wrestled and struggled with that. Some people talked about actually quite negative experiences that they'd had. But there was one that really jumped out at me, one quote, one person that said this. They just said, the doctors and nurses were worn down and they looked pretty well defeated. I was reading a psychologist, writings of a psychologist the other day, and he was talking about burnout. You might have heard of this concept. And he describes it as a profound weariness, characterized by fatigue, frustration, disengagement, stress, helplessness, hopelessness, emotional drain, exhaustion, and cynicism. And then Pete pointed out this article on the BBC, this headline, I don't know if anyone else saw this. We have the next slide. A GP in the north of Scotland has been suspended for punching a patient. Now, it wasn't unprovoked. The gentleman was under the influence of alcohol, the patient, that is, and had attacked the GP, and the GP had responded, but in a way that the court deemed to be disproportionate to the threat that he was under. And in his statement, the GP said that he took full responsibility for his actions, but he talked about the ongoing stress that he was under and the ongoing pressures of his work. And it was like in that moment, all of that just exploded and he couldn't hold it in anymore. So I don't know if any of you know doctors or social workers or teachers or church leaders even that get to this point where their attitude is kind of like this. If the next slide, Simon. I love mankind, but I can't cope with people anymore. Because sometimes people are pretty exhausting, yeah? So as Malcolm says, this is the third in a series through James. And one of the core messages of James is you cannot allow the world around you to teach you how to think. And the two previous messages are online if you've missed those and want to catch up. But at the end of last time, we were looking at how the world is caught up in this cycle of sin and death, but that Jesus came to reverse that. James says, God gave birth to us, and we are his first fruits. We are the beginning of his work at restoring the world. And the passage that we're going to look at today sort of continues that train of thought, but it looks at, well, what's our role in that? How do we join in with God's restoring work? So we'll read the whole passage in a minute, but I just want to read verse 27, which is the end. This is where we're aiming for this morning. And this is taken from the New Testament for Everyone, which is N.T. Wright's translation of the New Testament. As far as God the Father is concerned, pure, unsullied devotion works like this. You should visit orphans and widows in their sorrows and prevent the world from leaving its dirty smudge on you. So James says we are called to engage in this work of bringing justice and healing. You might know that at that time, widows and orphans were really the most vulnerable and the most oppressed people in society because there was very little opportunity for women to have any kind of employment, and there was no social services, there was no benefit system, there was no foster care or anything like that. So if the man of the house died, then orphans and widows were often left pretty destitute. So James is saying, as children of this restoring God, we should be most concerned with those who are most vulnerable. We're to get stuck into the mess of people's lives. But we're to do it without the world leaving its smudge on us. We're to do it without getting sucked back into the world's ways of thinking, back into this cycle of despair and hopelessness that ultimately leads to death. Without getting cynical and exhausted and depleted and frustrated and all of these other things that I listed earlier. So he's saying to do that, we need to change our minds, we need to change our thinking about how justice is achieved. Okay, so that's where we're going this morning. If you've got your Bibles with you, we're in James chapter 1. And I'm actually going to read from verse 16, which is the end of the section we looked at last time. Don't be deceived, my dear family. Every good gift, every perfect gift comes down from above, from the Father of lights. His steady light doesn't vary. It doesn't change and produce shadows. He became our Father by the word of truth. That was his firm decision. And the result is that we are a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So, my dear brothers and sisters, get this straight. Every person should be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. Human anger, you see, doesn't produce God's justice. So, put away everything that's sordid, all that overflowing malice, and humbly receive the word which has been planted within you and which has the power to rescue your lives. But be people who do the word, not merely people who hear it and deceive themselves. Someone who hears the word and doesn't do it, you see, is like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. He notices himself, but then he goes away and quickly forgets what he looked like. But the person who looks into the perfect law of freedom and goes on with it, not being a hearer who forgets, but a doer who does the deed, such a person is blessed in their doing. If anyone supposes that they are devout and does not control their tongue, but rather deceives their heart, such a person's devotion is futile. As far as God the Father is concerned, pure unsullied devotion works like this. You should visit orphans and widows in their sorrow and prevent the world leaving its dirty smudge on you. Now, this is quite an interesting passage because a lot of these verses, you could sort of take them by themselves. It's a bit like a collection of proverbs. And you could take each one on its own merit and you could go away and meditate on it. And it would be very beneficial. It would be a fruitful thing to do. But there's also all of these kind of connecting words between them, often between things that don't seem to follow on from each other in our way of thinking. And I think that's partly because James is making an argument in a way that's a bit different to the way that we make arguments. So we like things to be very logical, and you go from one thing to the next to the next. But James is sort of laying things alongside each other and coming back to things and going round, and so it's not in the order that we might expect it to be. So we're going to jump around a little bit as we look at this passage. And so he starts with talking about anger. Now, as I'm sure you are aware, we get angry when we feel like we've been wronged in some kind of way. And he's just been talking to these Jewish Christians about suffering and trials. That was the last message that we looked at. And it's quite reasonable that if this is what the Christians are going through, maybe they're going to feel angry about it. And anger says, something is wrong and I want to change it. I want to put things right. And we read at times that Jesus got angry. And Paul in Ephesians says that you can be angry, but don't sin. So anger in itself isn't necessarily sinful. But the NLT puts it like this. Don't sin by letting anger control you. Don't let the sun go down while you're still angry, for anger gives a foothold to the devil. So there's this warning that when we're in that state of anger, we're particularly vulnerable to going down roads or relying on strategies that are not godly ones. Now, as I was preparing this, I thought, I've got a real problem here because I know that no one in CCE ever gets angry. How are they going to relate to anything that I'm saying? So what I thought I'd do, just help you to understand what it's like to be angry, I thought I'd tell you a story of a time a few months ago now, maybe even longer than that, that I got angry. And it's the story of one of Pete and mine's first big arguments as a married couple. Okay. Now, I have checked with Pete. He's okay with me telling this story, probably because he comes out of it looking a bit better than I do. anyway, but there we go.
The only time.
Oh, that's unfair. So Pete cycles to and from work, and he's normally home sort of 5:30, maybe 6 o'clock. And on this particular evening, I'd got home first, and I was pottering around the flat doing bits and pieces, and I looked at the clock, and it was 6:10. I thought, oh, he's a bit late today. He's normally home by now. And it kind of got to 6:20. And I thought, I hope everything's okay. You know, I worry a bit about him cycling on these busy roads. You know, I hope nothing's happened. And then it got to 6:30. And I thought, gosh, you know, I really hope he's not been in an accident. And then it got to 6:45. And at this point, I'm thinking, you know, should I just phone A&E? You know, how do I, what do you do? Do you just phone them? Do I go down? You know, I had images of him being scooped off the pavement by the paramedics and taken into, you're laughing, this was stressful. You know, being taken into A&E, and then it gets to 7:00. And by this time, I am convinced that he is in resus and I'm going to get the police at the door any minute. 7:10, I hear the front door, bang. And I go into the kitchen and I look and I see Pete wheeling his bike across the back courtyard. It's okay. He's safe. What a relief. And then the time it takes for Pete to lock his bike away and come up the stairs and put his key in the door, that relief has changed into something a bit different. And in all honesty, I can't remember exactly what I said as he walked in, but he was greeted with something along the lines of, "You're so inconsiderate. How could you do this to me? Didn't you even think that I'd be worried? Why didn't you text me?" You know, and so on and so forth. And you see, in that moment, I felt that I'd been wronged. There'd been an injustice. And you could say in the grand scheme of things that it was quite trivial. But I really believed that my getting angry, my responding like that was going to put things right. Because I was going to leave him in no doubt that what he did was completely unacceptable and he was never to do that again. Problem is, James says that human anger doesn't produce God's justice. It very rarely actually puts things right. And if it does, it doesn't do it in the way that God wants it done. Because in that moment, I didn't care what excuses he had. I didn't care that his phone had died, that he'd had the worst day at work ever, that he'd been caught up with, you know, really difficult clients or whatever it was, and that was the reason he was late. You see, the world says that the way to put things right when we've been wronged or when someone else has been wronged is through violence. It's to try and control the other person, either through power or through manipulation, by somehow forcing your will onto them. And sometimes that's through physical violence. We see this a lot in films. There we go. Everyone loves to see the bad guys blown up, right? The bad guys get a kicking, or maybe their reputation is destroyed, or they lose all their money, something really bad. We want the good guy to do something bad to the bad guy at the end of a film, don't we? Because that restores the balance to the universe. I was reading the other day that by the age of 18, the average person, by 18, has seen 200,000 acts of violence on television, including 40,000 murders. By 18. The idea that violence put things right is endemic in our media. I was watching a program just yesterday where, you know, of course you had the good guys and the bad guys, and the bad guys thought the good guys had wronged them, so they beat them up, and the good guys responded by, by stealing all their money, and the bad guys responded by sending their henchmen after them, and it just escalated. But, you know, I didn't actually beat Pete up when he walked in through the door, did I? No, okay. Yeah. But actually, I was pretty aggressive. I wanted to belittle him, to insult him, to tell him what I really thought, to leave him in no doubt that he had, as I said, done something wrong. And he had no option but to change his behaviour. And I think this is what James is getting at in verse 26. So verse 26, he says, if you can't control your tongues, if you have to resort to verbal violence, to words that seek to control and manipulate and destroy, then your devotion is futile. Now, one of the things that I find quite helpful when I'm wrestling with a verse is to try and paraphrase it, because I figure if I understand it enough to put it in my own words, then I've got a good handle on what it's saying. But I really struggle to do that with this verse. So what is James getting at? Is he saying that if we ever respond in that kind of way, then God doesn't listen to us anymore, that he doesn't care about our worship? Is that what doesn't seem quite right? And then as I was wrestling with it, this paraphrase popped into my head, and it really made me stop and think. And it was this: if you feel the need to aggressively justify yourself, then you're worshipping an idol. And then I did a bit more digging into this word futile or worthless, some translations use. And it's used in a number of places in the New Testament and in the Greek Old Testament to talk about idols, because they're empty. They're non-gods, as Colin was talking about last week. And I think James is saying that in that moment, if you have to attack someone else, either physically or with your words, then you're relying on something that's not God. Because all through James, James is saying, where does your allegiance lie? Is it with God or the world? Do you do things God's way, or do you follow the world's teaching? And in that moment, we're relying on the world's strategies. Now, as Pete walked in through the door, where did I think the problem was? Him. It was all his fault. He needed to change. He was the one that had to do things differently, and I was in the right. I was completely justified in my response. So I thought. But there's a really interesting shift in verse 21 of this passage. So James says that, you know, human anger does not produce God's justice. So put away everything that's sordid, all that overflowing malice, and humbly receive the word which has been planted within you, and which has the power to save your life. The ESV puts it even more strongly. It says, rid yourselves of all sordidness and wickedness. James, he's the one that's got to rid himself of wickedness. He's the one with the problem. He's the one that needs to change. He needs to read the word of God better, not me. No, James said, rid yourself of these things. Focus on your response, not what may or may not be wrong with the other person. Look at the darkness in your own heart before you try and fix someone else's. Jesus said, take the log out of your eye before you try and fix the speck in your brother's eye, or your husband's, in my case. Danny Silk says this: in order to begin training yourself to respond in love, the first thing you need to accept is this truth. You cannot control other people. The only person you can control on a good day is yourself. Because when we get angry, when we feel that in some way the other person is a threat, we want to control them and put them right. That's our starting point. You're the problem, and I'm going to fix you. I'm going to make you change. No, James says, Look at what's going on in you. So, how do we do that? Well, shortly afterwards, might have been a few days, might have been a week, I can't remember, I was reading Hebrews, beginning of Hebrews, and it was just what had come up in my daily, the pattern I was following, my Bible reading. And what I tend to do is I tend to read a chapter and then I try and pick out one verse or, you know, one teaching to think about a bit further. And the verse that jumped out at me from Hebrews chapter 2 was this. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood, he himself, that's Jesus, likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Now, in that hour or so that I was waiting, what was it that was going through my mind? What was I worried about? What did I think had happened?
Been knocked over.
Yeah. Actually, I thought he'd been killed. That's what I was really worried about. That's what I was really frightened about. And so God started to speak to me about the fear of death. And I knew in my head that Jesus had come to destroy death and he'd come to destroy the fear of death, that that's what held us in slavery. And I could have told you that, and I could have told you that probably for the past 10 years or so. But in that moment, I realized I didn't believe it. Any of you had that experience where something you know is true and you've believed to be true all your life and then suddenly you realise that somewhere in here you don't really know it? Now, anger and fear are really closely linked. Okay, we're going to have a quick physiology lesson. Okay, there are, broadly speaking, two states or two extremes, and we lie on a spectrum, that human beings can be in. And anger and fear are both responses to threats. And we go into a state of what's known as fight or flight. So if a bear were to run into this room, highly unlikely, but were it to happen, we would all perceive a risk to our safety, okay? And our hearts would start to beat faster, and we'd start to breathe a bit quicker, and our muscles would tense, because we'd be getting ready to run or to fight. But we also know that that state changes our brains. Okay, and what we call higher functions, so our capacity to reason, gets shut down. Our capacity to learn new information gets shut down. Our capacity to empathize and be compassionate for someone else's situation gets shut down. Our ability to control our impulses gets shut down. Because in that moment, the last thing you want to do is have a philosophical discussion about the best response to the situation. You just want to run. But actually, if that threat is another person, and you can't learn new information, you can't empathize, you can't control your impulses, that's quite a different situation. And then the other end of the spectrum is rest and recovery. It's sometimes called feed and breed. And all of those aspects of our brain, those higher functions, upregulate. So we can be sociable, we can form bonds, we can be compassionate, all of these sort of things. Now, anger and fear are natural responses. Okay, there's nothing inherently wrong with being frightened of a bear. The question is, what do we do in that situation? Where is our trust in that moment? How do we respond? Who are we trusting on to rescue and save us? And James says that the Word of God has the power to show us what lies in our hearts. What we're really trusting, where our allegiance lies. And he uses the illustration of a mirror. So let's read those verses again from verse 23. Someone who hears the word but doesn't do it is like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. He notices himself, but then he goes away and quickly forgets what he looked like. But the person who looks into the perfect law of freedom and goes on with it, not being a hearer who forgets, but a doer who does the deed, such a person is blessed in their doing. So he says we can see something of the truth about ourselves. We can see that big black smudge across our face, Or as I said in the first of this series, we can see that we're wearing glasses that are distorting our perspective. But once we've done that, we need to do something about it. Otherwise, we're just kidding ourselves that everything's okay when we've just been shown that it's not. But often, as I said, I think in the first week, our tendency is to try and jump straight to doing. Okay, so we recognize that there's this truth that we don't really believe. And so we say, well, I'm just going to believe it. I'm just going to try and convince myself that it's true, even though there's something down here that is telling me otherwise. And that sort of change is quite superficial and actually doesn't tend to last very long. There's a middle step, James says. Those who look and who go on with it. Now that word, go on with it, literally is those who stay alongside it. Those who sit with it. Those, in verse 21, he says, who welcome it. Who receive it into themselves. Who nurture that living seed that God has placed within them. Those who allow it to really transform them from the inside out. Those who engage with this law of liberty, this word that sets us free. That isn't about us just trying harder, but about those shackles really falling off. And actually, that's God putting things right. Slowly, patiently, graciously, lovingly, generously. And so over the next couple of weeks, I kept coming back to that verse. And I asked God the question, why can't I believe this? Because there's this gap that I know it's true, but I'm not living like it. So what's really going on? Because if that doesn't change, I'm never going to believe it. And I won't go into the whole story, but a couple of weeks later, I was praying with some people up in the small hall here. And God began to show me something that I believed about him that wasn't true. Something that I'd learned actually at a really young age that made me think that I had to defend myself from the fear of death. So James takes us on this transition from you're the problem and I'm going to fix you to actually I'm broken too. I need fixed and only God can do it. A couple of weeks ago, Pete and Drew went off for the weekend to a bothy on the West Coast. And he said to me before he left, this bothy was on the edge of a cliff. What could possibly go wrong? And so I said, as he left, look, will you just try and text me and let me know that everything's okay? And usually, actually, Pete's signal is pretty good, even in the far remote places that he goes to. But of course, this time, he didn't have a single bar. And so Friday night goes by, and Saturday morning goes by, and the weather outside's pretty windy. And Saturday afternoon goes by, Saturday night, Sunday morning, and then Sunday afternoon, I get a message saying, sorry, been out of range, we're on our way home, see you soon. Now, over that weekend, yes, there were thoughts that flashed into my mind of, I hope everything's okay, I hope he's not been in an accident, I hope they've not fallen off a cliff, I hope he's not got lost up a hill. But actually, I had a sense of peace. And so Pete walked in to a very different wife on Sunday night. Now, does that mean that I'm never going to get angry again? No. Does that mean that we never have arguments? No. Because we're all work in process. But there's something of the healing that God brought that meant I no longer felt the need to react violently to that situation. So, what has all of this got to do with caring for orphans and widows? I hear you ask. You're all thinking it, right? So the word that James uses is visit. We're to visit orphans and widows. And again, that word is used in the Greek Old Testament particularly to talk about God's visiting. God visiting people to bring healing and help and rescue. So there's a sense that it's not our help and rescue we're taking, it's God's help and rescue. We're to take that healing power to those who really need it. But the thing is, let's go back to this spec. Thank you, put that back up. People who are oppressed, who are suffering, who are in pain, are by very nature going to be at this end of the spectrum. They have all kinds of threats that they're facing on a daily basis, to their safety, to their provision, that maybe they don't know where their next meal is coming from, maybe they don't know who's going to come through the door tomorrow. And they live in a state of anxiety and fear. And they're taught, as we all are, this is not to single them out, we're all taught that the way to deal with that is through violence and control and by manipulation and enforcing our will on other people. Now, I said I work as a doctor and I spend a lot of my time with people that are in pain or sick or suffering or frightened. And it's fairly common, particularly you see this in relatives, where relatives are really frightened and they just lash out because they want to fix the situation, they want something to change. But if we're both in that state, if we're both buying into this sense that what we have to do is control one another and keep ourselves safe and protect ourselves at all costs, then we just feed off each other. And it's quite unusual that, like the GP, we punch someone. But actually staying in that state of stress chronically is what leads to burnout. Because we have to protect ourselves from this other person. And we're to do things without the world leaving its smudge on us. But the thing is that as we're healed, the way that we relate to others changes. And so actually, it doesn't matter what state the other person is in. If I'm connected to God, and I'm in a place of peace in Him, and I don't need to keep myself safe, then that relationship changes. That encounter is a healthy one. It's one of the great things about the counseling course that Malcolm mentioned is that it starts with helping us understand why we respond the way that we do. It starts with us examining the darkness in our own heart so that we can help other people. And even if you never want to be a counsellor, by nature of being human, you will encounter people who are suffering, who are in pain, who are frightened, who are hurting. And if you have examined your own heart and met God in your own brokenness, then actually you can really do some good. But if you're buying into this cycle of violence, then we get sucked back into this cycle of death that we looked at last time. And so James says, we get to this place where we can say to people, look, come and meet the God who can make us both whole. It's not about us fixing people. Sometimes it's not even about us fixing their situation, although, you know, we are called to do good, and James comes on to that later. But we've learnt that we're all broken and we all need God's healing. And we're the first fruits. God has encountered us. God has changed something in us. That means we can invite other people into this healing. I want to finish with a quote from Amy Milligan's blog. Some of you might have read this already. But Amy worked last winter at the Bethany Care Shelter, and she talked in this blog about how her encounter with some of these people began to touch on her own story and her own brokenness. And she says this, I began to recognize that I'd not let go of some of the hurt, fear, and labels which had been put on me as a child in care. This conviction fueled me to fully immerse myself into giving God full control of my life. The healing which I received meant I could move forward and care for the fatherless on a deeper, more God-directed level. God is making all things new. God is bringing about generous justice. He is making a new heaven and a new earth. All he asks of me is to show people that they are his beloved sons and daughters whom he wants to bring home. He is the perfect parent. But if we don't believe that, then we can't communicate that to other people. So the invitation is to allow God to transform us to welcome the word of truth, to nurture it, and then take it out. And at that point, we're no longer reacting out of our own brokenness, but we're pursuing something of God's vision and God's dream for the healing of humanity.